G'day, I'm Indy Wood, and you're listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues, events, and personalities from around the Bega Valley. Well, this week on the program, this weekend just gone, was World Mangrove Day. And it just so happens that we currently have a well-recognised mangrove expert staying in here in the Bega Valley. Jock McKenzie is the director of Mangrove Watch. We're going to find out from him what's so important about mangroves and the significance of the mangroves in this south coast region of New South Wales. That's coming up on this episode of The Local Update. And as we do each week, we'll also catch up with local historian Graham Farram. This week, Graham returns to Bermagui to talk about two characters, Sam Sinclair and Walter Henry Childs. Later in the episode, he'll also return to someone that we've spoken of before, Alice Otten and the Davidson Whaling Station in Eden.
Today I'm going to be bringing you two biographies and three tales. My first biography is from Bermagui, A Century of Features and Families by Ron Gahar with Judy Hearn, 1994. It's on page 103 that I'm looking. Sinclair. Samuel Robert Sinclair was born at Dalton near Gunning on September the 2nd, 1882. He was the third son and child of Albert Dunbar Sinclair, born 1851, a blacksmith of Kiama, and Sarah Dowling, born 1853 of Dalton, who were married there on August the 21st, 1873. Sam was predeceased by two brothers, Albert, born 1875, and Walter, born 1877, and possibly to other infant children. His other siblings were Oliver, born 1885, Rosanna, 1887 to 1982, May, born 1891, August, born 1893, and Elsie, born 1895. In late 1901, Sam enlisted in the 5th Battalion, Australian Commonwealth Horse, for service in the South African Boer War. With the service number 57, he was one of four farriers assigned to A Squadron Lancers, consisting of four troops. The other units in the 5th were B Squadron, Mounted Rifles, and D Squadron, Australian Horse, making up a total of 16 troops. Qualifications included height, 158 centimetres, age, 20 years, chest, 85 centimetres, single status, except for senior NCOs. Equipment consisted of brownfield service jacket, pants, puttees and hat, plus bandoliers, saddlery, and fully horsed. The war was almost over. Henry Morant and Peter Hancock had been executed in February 1902, but lack of communications ensured that Sam's unit would embark on the transport Columbian from Sydney, May 22nd, 1902. Thus, 22 officers, 465 other ranks, and 490 horse arrived in Durban on June the 18th, 1902, to find that a peace treaty had been signed on May the 31st. The unit re-embarked at Durban on the transport Manchester Merchant, July 1st, 1902, and reached Sydney August the 1st, 1902. In Sam's unit, service number 55 was Frank Leighton Sinclair, who may have been a cousin. Relics of Sam's war days are in the family museum Bega and include chocolates sent to the soldiers by Queen Victoria. Other artefacts are believed to reside in a museum in Cooma. From his early days, Sam was skillful with horses and became a farrier and blacksmith. He spent his youth in at Milton and after the South African War, went up to the North Coast and literally fought for the job of blacksmith at Grafton. He worked his way south, eventually reaching Bermagui in 1904 on a bicycle. With a few shillings in his pocket, and he finally settled there to the great benefit to the community. He married a Naruma lady, Lillian Riley, in 1908. There were no children, but they fostered a Down syndrome child, Violet Greaves, born 1916. Lillian predeceased Sam in 1943, and Violet was returned to the care of relatives when Sam died in the Bega Hospital on August the 19th, 1964, as the result of a fall from a ladder. Thus, Bermagui lost one of its best-known and highly respected citizens in his 82nd year, and it was his good friend, Edgar Jaggers, who personally attended to the grave memorial in the form of white cement, seashells, small anvil, and a horseshoe, plus a suitable plaque. I'd mentioned Edgar Jaggers earlier as one of the gentlemen who did a lot of work sleeper cutting up there at Bermagui. There's quite a long section of Sam's life in Bermagui, but I'll just give you a couple of paragraphs that caught my attention so that you know a bit more who he was. He was a wheelwright, built drays, shod bullocks as well as horses, made coffins with cardboard handles, storage tanks, made horseshoes himself to suit any beast, leased a bakery and a butchery, and even pulled teeth. A little bit of a talk about he might have been part-time midwife as well. In the 1930s, Toohey's Brewery saw the connection and immortalised Sam Sinclair by promoting the image of his smithy in his apron, a foaming tankard in hand, and a caption, "Here's Toohey." The image appeared on hotel mirrors everywhere and on one large neon sign over the Sydney Brewery opposite Central Station, which flashed its message and Sam over the city until the early 1980s when the brewery was demolished. It should be noted that Sam was almost teetotal. I remember that particular neon sign, and it was rather fine, exactly as they described it there, and the hand with the tankard went up and down, and I as a child going into Sydney, I remember seeing that. As the horse lost its importance and the motor car era arrived, Sam quickly adapted, and by 1928 had built Bermagui South Service Station, on the corner of Lamont and Bunga Streets. His sign read, "Just toot and we're out." He liked the sort of bit of vernacular. There are 32 page references in the index. I'll just give you the first one. The first reference is page 20. In 1920, a punt was built in Bermagui by Ern Millikan for crossing the Bega River at Tathra. It was towed to Tathra by Harry Jubb in Sam Sinclair's boat, Cooey, where it was equipped with wire rope from shore to shore and was wound across the river by hand using a 1.2 metre pulley wheel. That's still out the back today in the rain somewhere. I'm sort of looking at things in the museum just at the moment. And next time I'm going to do a whole lot of things in the museum, but that's going to be a little while yet. I wanted to look at Walter Henry Childs because I was interested in the things that we have by artists in the museum, and it's a long list, you know. I could make a very, very long list of things that have been made by people with a little bit of artistic intent. But one person who used that artistic intent to everybody's advantage was Walter Henry Childs. This is out of Bailey's History of Bega, the biographical section. In fact, it's the only part that mentions Walter Henry Childs. There's no other mention of him in the body of the text. Notable pioneers and worthy citizens of Bega, page 109, so that's right at the back. Walter Henry Childs, 1873 to 1963. It is said that no son of Bega has been a greater credit to his native town than W.H. Childs, who was born in Bega in 1873 and received his first schooling at the Bega Public School, just down the road from us here, when W.H. Wilson was headmaster, walking in from his home at North Bega along McCarthy's Lane, now Bega Street, each morning. After completing his education at Harris's High School, he entered the office of Rawlinson and Bland, solicitors in Church Street. Whilst in this office, he became a member of Major Bland's Bega Mounted Rifles, where he held the rank of corporal. He served too as a member of the Bega Brass Band, and later married a Bega girl, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. George Blacker. I'm told that she had a musical bent as well. He left the solicitor's office to enter the police force in 1892, where he gained rapid promotion, becoming the youngest inspector to be appointed to the then New South Wales police force. His fingerprint research made him world famous, and he was finally appointed commissioner of police. As a senior officer, he took the blame when De Groot slashed the ribbon at the opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge and missed out on the knighthood for the normal knighthood for his service. He revisited his hometown on several occasions when he was tendered civic receptions. A couple of other mentions of him in a book called Bega, 1885 to 1985, the centenary year. That's when Bega became a municipality, and there's 100 years. It was sponsored by the IMB Building Society at the time, so we're talking 1985. A little section called Bega's Famous Sons and Daughters, it notes. A few years ago, a trust was established in his name for the yearly art awards at Bega High School. Some excellent examples of his artistic talent are seen in two framed pictures at the Bega Family Museum. That's here again, of course, and they're out in the kitchen on the way to the pantry, and they were purportedly done in 1888. Bengal tigers is one of them, pencil work. And the other looks like a provincial village, maybe in France, could be. Looks a bit like that. Looks like a very early Norman Lindsay etching, but it's all pencil work. Well done. Lupton, slightly more human note now. Lupton's Bega Primary School, 2010, on page 17. Childs wrote his recollections of the school he attended in 1878. Page 18. I also remember well in the junior classes the fun we had with the old pump, which stood at the back of the school. We would hold hand over the outlet of the pump, and another would pump hard so the water would be forced out at the top in a stream. There were the usual bare spaces for marbles, cricket, hoops, and other games as schoolboys played and still play. A ring with the grass worn off around which we used to race, and on which I broke my left arm over a high jump held by the two scholars. Four brothers and sisters of mine received their education at the old school. Of course, being a commissioner of police for New South Wales, there is a police museum in Sydney, and at one time I got some information from them, including his service record. The only blot on his record as a younger officer was that he was seen once jumping onto a moving tram. I had a word with him about that, and it was written down, black mark in his book. Otherwise, he was quite successful. Quoting now from the Tales of the Far South Coast, Volume 2. So this is April 1984 that it was published. And this is a tale. There are many factual errors in this, which I won't go into immediately, but we can look at it later. This is a tale, a man who's reminiscing, it seems to be. Old Cobargo Ambulance Lives On by C. Gannon. My first memory of the Cobargo Ambulance was when Mr. George Martin, father of the late Mr. Jack Martin, was selling raffle tickets for sixpence each towards the cost of buying it. Where it came from or who built it, I have no idea. But it did not have leather springs. It was a vehicle with four solid rubber-tired wheels and pole to be drawn by two horses. When the ambulance duly arrived, a shed was built on the bottom side of the Cobargo School of Arts to house it. As far as I know, the first and only person it was used for was the late Mr. Jack Rankin, who was taken to Bermagui in it to be put on the boat to go to Sydney to have a leg amputated. As years went by, it lay in the shed, but not idle. It was a very popular hideout for the boys to park in with their tarts. In fact, so popular that one night when I took a patient there, two boys and two girls were in it. The Yowry girls also used to love a ride in the old ambulance. And so it remained in its shed until the mid-20s. Then four or five of us pulled it down the road to Alex Boyd's coach workshop, situated where the Cobargo swimming pool is today. The pole was removed and a set of shafts put in to be drawn by one horse. This conversion work was done for one George Trad, an Assyrian hawker, and so started George the Hawker in his spick and span new cart. He travelled all local roads until his death in Bega. When George became ill, he was camped at the old Bimbaya butter factory and was taken to Bega, where he died. As Trad had no relatives in Australia, the local police attended to his estate. The old ambulance was taken to Bega and was parked in Balmain Brothers' second-hand car yard and remained there for some years. Then one day, Sister Bernice Smith, who had an eye for old history, bought it for £10. I don't know who got the £10. Bernice Smith had it taken to her home, which was at the top end of Carp Street, Bega, where it remained for some years in the backyard. Then it was taken to the new Bega Valley Historical Society Museum, where it is still to be seen on show. The shed in which it was housed at Cobargo finished up with Mr. Jim Dowling and was moved to a site near Naraya Creek. Then his son Horace used it for a stable for racehorses and coursing dogs. You can still see that ambulance and wagon right here in the museum, but there's quite a few errors in that story because that's 1984. Since then, we've had quite a few people come in, even family of George's, and there are other stories here. If you're listening to this, come and ask people, well, what's going on with that ambulance? I want to have a look at it. From the same Tales of the Far South Coast, Volume 2, a little thing out of Tales of Wales by Alice Otten. On page 96, she's quoting from a letter in her possession. But overall is the remembrance of how importantly the Wailing Davidsons loomed in the Eden of my youth. How widely known their whaling and boating exploits were. How prominently and popularly they figured in social and sporting gatherings. Archer as much as any of the clan. He was as game as they came and as agile as a cat. I can remember seeing from the Eden lookout cliffs a whaleboat smashed in by a whale. An archer who had been thrown into the sea with the others practically running up the steer oar into the boat. All were fortunately picked up by the pickup boat. 2 years later, Tales of the Far South Coast, Volume 3, has a much more extensive story by Alice Otten, this is 1986, called The Simple Pleasures. Well, there's quite a list of simple pleasures that she goes to, being on the waters down there at Eden, going to dances, having people to come, music, gardening, riding horses. It's all quite nice, simple pleasures. But this is the little bit that I'd like to give you today, and it's the last thing today. Page 103, Volume 3 of Tales of the South Coast. When I was about 15, a cousin and I were being taken across the bay in a little dinghy. It was a beautiful, calm morning, and the men were chasing a whale about 3/4 of a mile away, up the bay, near Moutrie's Reef. You could see the flukes glistening in the sun, and I'll never forget hearing that whale moan. The killers were harrying it, and the whalers endeavouring to spear it with the harpoons. They eventually got the whale, but it was the first time I realised that it was murder.
Graham Farram is a long-term resident of the Bega Valley and a member of Bega's Historical Society and the Pioneers Museum. If you'd like to join us, we record these sessions at 11 o'clock on a Monday morning in the Pioneers Museum, on the corner of Bega and Auckland Street in Bega. This weekend just gone was World Mangrove Day, and it just so happens that we currently have a renowned mangrove expert staying in the region. Jock McKenzie is the director of Mangrove Watch, a citizen science group that encourages you to keep an eye on the condition of the mangroves in the waterways that you frequent. I caught up with Jock recently, and he tells me that mangroves act as breeding ground for seafood, will clean the waterways that they live in, meaning better water quality for things like oysters, and also have a strong part to play in our fight against climate change.
They provide heaps of amazing ecosystem services that support, protect and enhance coastal communities across Australia, really. They're right there on the coastal zone. They provide all sorts of benefits like seafood. The seafood that's on your plate has probably lived in mangroves or eaten something that has lived in mangroves. They protect shorelines from erosion and buffer coastal towns from storms and floods.
They're obviously coastal, but native to particular parts of Australia or all over?
So mangroves are distributed all across Australia, pretty much in every state except Tasmania. There's mangroves. They occur on protected shorelines within estuaries. They do occur as far south as Corner Inlet in Victoria. That's the southernmost mangroves in the world. There's much higher diversity of mangrove species in the north. Down here in the Bega region, there's only 2 mangrove species, and down in Victoria, there's only 1. That's compared to, say, 36 in the Daintree River estuary north of Cairns.
Is that changing as water temperatures increase?
So mangroves are migrating polewards with increasing temperatures because the distribution of mangroves is dependent on rainfall and temperature. But what we're not really finding that in Australia so much. That's more happening in the northern latitudes, whereas what we're finding in Australia is that there is some possible species migration south.
I guess one of the most common kind of attitudes towards mangroves is that they provide a barrier between you and I and access to waterways. Is that kind of negative attitude a problem?
Yeah, well, I think mangroves have often had a bit of a bad rap in the past because they occupy that valuable coastal space between land and sea where people want to build their houses and build ports and build boat ramps and that sort of thing. So people have in the past cleared mangroves to make way for other land uses. So areas like Brisbane, for instance, there's been, you know, 60% of the mangroves were removed out of the Brisbane River to make way for airports and port development. So historically, there's been a lot of mangrove removal to make way for coastal infrastructure. These days, we're a lot better at protecting mangroves. In most states, mangroves are protected under various legislation. So, yeah, there's less removal these days, but that doesn't mean that we're not still damaging them and they're not still impacted by other indirect threats.
One of the pieces of most common knowledge these days around climate change is that plantations are involved in the process of carbon capture and storage. I was surprised to learn the other day, though, that mangroves play a really big role in this.
Yeah, that's right. Mangroves are super carbon storage. They are one of the key players in the fight against climate change. So that's one of the main ecosystem services they provide. Mangroves store 5 times more carbon than any other forest type per hectare. That said, there is only a small amount of mangroves on the Earth's surface. So compared to a rainforest, the total carbon stores less. But per hectare, mangroves store 5 times more carbon, but they trap it 50 times faster. And that's all down to the little crabs that you see running around in the mangrove forest. So those little tiny crabs, because mangroves live in the salt water, they turn over leaves really quickly to get rid of the salt. And when those leaves fall on the mangrove forest floor, the crabs think, woohoo, lunch. And they go and clean them up, take them into their burrows and bury them underground where they save them for a snack later on. And when they eat them, obviously what they eat goes out eventually, and that's carbon burial in process. So that carbon sequestration can store huge amounts of carbon and take that carbon out of the atmosphere and store it away forever. So as far as strategies to work towards protecting Australia against climate change and gearing towards a low carbon future, restoring and protecting mangroves is actually one of the key elements of Australia's strategy in that. So they call that blue carbon. That's the carbon that's stored in marine ecosystems. So protecting, restoring and enhancing blue carbon habitats is one of the tools that we can use to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere to protect against future damaging impacts of climate change.
Let's talk about the mangroves in this region. You and I both know that places like Maroombula and Tathra and Bermagui are pretty famous for decent seafood and oysters. Is there a relationship between those mangroves and the quality of that seafood?
Definitely. There's, I guess, this area itself is known for its oysters. So Wappingo Lake, for instance, has some of Australia's best oysters. And that's in part due to the really good water quality in those systems. So mangroves act as natural filters. They're like the kidneys of the coast. So they're taking all the nasties that come down from the catchment, so sediments, nutrients, and other pollutants. Because of their structure, you might see all those roots that stick up out of the ground, the nematophores, the breathing roots that they have, and all the stem structure there. That intercepts the water and the tidal flow and slows those water currents down, which means that sediment falls out of the water column and is deposited in the mangroves. And when that happens, after a tide has been through the mangroves and sediments deposited on the surface, within a few minutes even, that sediment is bound by microfilm on the surface that binds a sediment, and then it gets biotubated by, turned over by animals, crabs, and other organisms in the mangroves, and then it stays there. So that trap acts as a trap for sediments and nutrients, and that cleans the water, giving this area the clean water which those high quality oysters depend on. And as far as fish and other seafood is concerned, like I mentioned previously, most of the seafood that ends up on our plate has either spent part of its life cycle in the mangroves or has eaten something that has depended on mangroves. So mangroves are really important as fish habitat, as nursery grounds. In this region, there's the river mangrove, so that's one of the two mangrove species that occurs in this region, that occurs mostly in the upper estuaries, but that forms a dense hedge along shorelines, and when the tide is high, that's where prawns often breed, and the juvenile prawns go up into those leaves on the high tide and hang out there where they provide protection from other critters. So prawn breeding grounds, really important, as well as fish breeding grounds, and then, of course, part of the whole near-shore coastal food web that, that we all love. So if you've eaten a fish or some seafood lately, there's a bit of mangrove in you.
You're obviously passionate about getting people involved in what they'd call citizen science. How can people get involved in working with mangroves?
Well, Mangrove Watch is a citizen science program that engages, educates and empowers local communities to become mangrove champions through citizen science by giving people that direct engagement with mangrove habitats through either experiences or data collection. So with the Mangrove Watch program, our main tool that we use is the shoreline video assessment method. So people can go out in boats and film the shoreline with a GPS and a still camera, so and collect image data of the mangroves. The great thing about the program is that you don't need to know anything about mangroves. You just need to be able to get access to a Mangrove Watch kit and then have access to a boat as well to go out to film those shorelines, which that data gets sent to me, and we do some analysis and create reports on estuarine habitat health condition and the structure and all those attributes that give us an indication of how healthy those mangroves are and the structure and the diversity in that system. And then we can use that to inform future management actions and where we might do restoration or implement some action to protect the mangroves. Part of the whole benefit of citizen science is that it's a community science partnership, because by working with local people, you really get to understand what the local issues are. And so in this area, I'm a blow-in from now Victoria, so I can come here and go, oh, the mangroves have died in Wappango Lake, for instance. And but people who live in that area, know that area well, will be able to tell me when they died, why they died, and most importantly, what that means to them. And then we can work together to see what we can do about that, whether there's things we can do in the local area to improve the management so we can improve the health and also improve the resilience, the capacity of the mangroves to respond to climate change as it's coming.
Would you work with an already existing group of some sort in this region, for example, if someone wanted to set something up?
Yeah, definitely. So how we work is that community organisations in a region who are interested in protecting and understanding about their local mangrove habitats can contact us, and we work together to apply for funding through that organisation to get a Mangrove Watch kit, get some training going, and then have people going out and doing the filming and also have the data assessment, and importantly, give feedback of the results back to the community. So it's all about community-based mangrove conservation initiatives. Mangrove Watch is just a program, so it's a tool, and it's really about community ownership to create local mangrove champions who are best placed to deal with the local issues that threaten mangroves in that area. Every estuary is different. The things that are threatening mangroves down in Eden, for instance, are different to what's happening to mangroves in Marimbula. So it really needs local people in each place who understand what's going on in that local area, but may not have an overall understanding of mangrove habitats, so that we can link together, form that partnership, and get better outcomes for coastal conservation.
I'm trying to think of examples. Local land care, local Aboriginal Land Council, who would it be?
Groups who we already work with are groups like land care groups, traditional owner, Aboriginal corporations. In Cairns, we work with the Cairns and Far North Environment Centre. In southern Queensland, it's with the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland. And down in the Barwon Estuary, it's just a bunch of community people who want to go out and look at mangroves, who got together and decided it was a thing to do. So they individually went and raised some funds to do that. So, but most of the time, it's through a community organisation that has an environmental interest that has access to boats and can get access to boats. And we work a lot with environmental education centres as well. So I know down in Eden there's a good environmental ed centre who probably would be very well placed to do the Mangrove Watch program.
If people want to get more info about who you are and what you're up to, where can they go?
Well, they can jump onto the Mangrove Watch website at www.mangrovewatch.org.au or they can just send me an email, mangrovewatch@gmail.com, or jump on the socials, check out Facebook, Mangrove Watch. If you type in Mangrove Watch into the search engine, you'll find us.
Is there anything that's unique about the mangroves in this southeast region?
Well, there's two particularly unique things, and both those things are linked. One is that in Marimbula, it's the southern distribution of the river mangroves, so we're at a cut-off point of species distribution. So south of Marimbula, you don't get, you only have one species. And that's important because this is a place where we will see change in the mangrove distribution. We're also seeing changes in the phenology, so the flowering and fruiting of the grey mangrove in places like this. So when that flowering and fruiting happens is occurring earlier and earlier as temperatures rise. So it's important that we have people out there documenting those kind of changes. So not just how healthy the mangroves are, but just where the mangroves are and what species are there. Because I think whilst the river mangrove, that Aegiceris science name, is documented to be as far south as Marimbula, it's quite possible that it is starting to occur further south. So it'd be really great to have people out there looking to see if this species is occurring further south, to get an understanding of how mangroves are responding to climate change, and also to see how that flowering and fruiting period of the grey mangrove is changing in the area. And second to that, I think one of the special things about this region linked back to the oysters is that historically a lot of those river mangroves were cleared from these estuaries, so there's actually been local extinctions of that species because they were cleared to make for use as oyster poles to tie the racks to. Obviously being mangrove wood, it's very salt tolerant and doesn't degrade in the salt water, so it makes good sense to use them as timber for oyster racks. But because of that historical clearing, there's actually some areas which haven't had that species occur for quite a while. So it would be good to know if it's coming back into some of those local estuaries and increasing in its distribution now that that pressure has stopped.
Sounds like it'd be important for us to set up a watch group in this region then.
Well, definitely. I think that they're obviously, being at the interface between land and sea, they're exposed to a whole lot of natural pressures anyway, from coastal storms as well as floods. And but now with climate change, we're seeing sea level rise, more frequent and severe storms and flooding, extreme droughts, even extreme bushfires are having an impact on the mangroves. So there's reports of near Nowra, there's estuaries where the mangroves were burnt by the bushfires, and that's really unusual. Mm. And then on top of that, we've got all the stuff that people are doing. So the small-scale local disturbance of people putting in a boat ramp or trimming the mangroves to make a better view, or there's catchment land use effects, so pollutants coming down the waterways. There's altered hydrology, there's cattle grazing, feral animals, and people just driving on mangroves and tidal wetland habitats, dumping rubbish. The list goes on. There's a whole lot of local issues that are probably impacting mangroves in this area. And the only way that mangroves are going to survive climate change is if we give them the best chance possible. And that means we have to reduce and ultimately remove all those other human impacts so that mangroves are in the best place to survive climate change. And part of that is also to increase just general local community awareness of how important and awesome mangroves are, so that if someone is damaging mangroves, that the local community says, well, that's not okay. Or if there is a proposal to build a marina or a new restaurant that wipes out mangrove habitats along a shoreline, then people in the community go, hey, well, that's where my fish come from, or that's cleaning the waters for the oysters, or that's just generally making the coastal environment what it is around this area, which is obviously brings tourists. So understanding that will mean that people are more likely to protect it. And that's what I mean about inspiring local mangrove champions, people who can advocate for for mangrove conservation, because, well, I think they need, with all the issues happening with the threats of climate change and our human impacts, they definitely need someone to stand up for them.
Jock McKenzie is the director of Mangrove Watch. You can find more info about how you can start your own Mangrove Watch group by clicking the link on the website, indymedia.com.au. Listening to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues, events and personalities from around the Bega Valley. My name's Indy Wood. Thank you to my guest, Jock McKenzie, Director of Mangrove Watch, and to my regular contributor, Graham Farram. Indy Media wishes to recognise the Yuin people as the traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast and pay respects to Elders past, present and emerging. For any info about this episode or previous episodes of The Local Update, you can find that at indymedia.com.au. My name's Indy Wood. Thank you so much for your company this week. Catch you again next time. Bye now.